No, she didn't say anything.
Well, I'm a little lost here, Jacob, since you came home from your tutoring session very upset, and I think there's still something bothering you. Here's the thing about Asperger's syndrome. Jacob won't lie. So when he says he didn't have an argument with Jess, I believe him. But that doesn't mean he wasn't traumatized by something else that relates to her. Maybe he walked in on her having sex with her.
Theo. Live from Townsend, the reporter wraps up, I'm Lucy McNeil. I look at my mother. That's Jess, I say, the obvious. Oh my God, she murmurs. That poor girl. I don't understand. I totally don't understand. My mother grabs my arm. This information doesn't leave this room, she says. You think Jacob isn't going to find out? He reads the papers. He's online. She pinches the bridge of her nose. He's so fragile right now, Theo. I can't throw this at him yet. Just give me a little while so I can figure out how. I take the remote out of her hand and turn the TV off. Then, muttering some excuse about an essay, I run upstairs to my room and lock the door. I walk in circles, my arms braced behind my head like I'm cooling off after running a marathon. I run through everything I heard that senator say and the reporter. The police chief, for God's sake, who said the disappearance is a priority. Whatever the fuck that means. I wonder if it will turn out to be a big hoax. Like that college girl who vanished and later said she was abducted and it turned out that she was making the whole story up to get attention. I kind of hope that's what happens. Because the alternative is something I don't want to think about. Here's all I really need to know. Jess Ogilvie is missing. And I was one of the last people to see her.
This ends Disc 4. House Rules, Disc 5.
Rich. On the answering machine at the Robertsons' house, there are 6 messages. One is from Mark McGuire, asking Jess to call him when she gets back. One is from a dry cleaner, letting her know that her skirt is ready. One is identified by caller ID as E. Hunt. The message says, Hi Jess, this is Jacob's mom. Can you give me a call? The other 3 messages are hang-ups, and all 3 came from the number registered to Jess Ogilvie's mobile phone. That tells me either she's a battered woman in hiding, trying to get the nerve to call her boyfriend and failing, or her boyfriend is covering his ass after accidentally killing her. I spend Friday crossing off the names in Jess Ogilvie's daytimer. My first call is to the 2 girls whose names pop up the most often in the history of months past. Alicia and Kara are grad students, like Jess. Alicia has cornrowed hair that hangs to her waist, and Kara is a tiny blonde wearing camouflage cargo pants and black work boots. Over coffee at the student center, they admit they haven't seen Jess since Tuesday.
She missed an exam with the Gorgon, Kara says. Nobody misses an exam with the Gorgon.
The Gorgon?
Professor Gorgona, she explains. It's a seminar course on special education.
Gorgona, I write in my notes. Has Jess ever gone away for a few days before?
Yeah, once, Alicia says. She went to Cape Cod for a long weekend and didn't tell us beforehand. She went with Mark, though, Kara adds, and she wrinkles her nose.
I take it you aren't a fan of Mark McGuire?
Is anyone? Alicia says. He doesn't treat her right.
What do you mean by that?
If he says jump, she doesn't even ask how high. She goes out and buys a pogo stick. We haven't seen a lot of her since they started hooking up, Kara says. Mark likes to keep her all to himself.
So do most abusive partners, I think.
Detective Mattson, Alicia says. She's going to be okay, right?
A week ago, Jess Ogilvie was probably sitting here where I am, drinking coffee with her friends, and freaking out about the Gorgon's upcoming exam. I hope so, I say. People don't just disappear. There's always a reason, or an enemy with a grudge. There's always a loose thread that starts to unravel. The problem is that Jess Ogilvie is apparently a saint.
I was surprised when she missed the exam,
Professor Gorgona says, a slight woman with a white bun and a trace of a foreign accent. She doesn't seem nearly as threatening as Alicia and Kara made her out to be.
She's my star student, really. She's getting her master's and writing an honors thesis at the same time. Graduated with a 4.0 from Bates and worked with Teach for America for 2 years before she decided to make a career out of it.
Is there anyone who might be jealous of the fact that she does so well in class? I ask.
Not that I've noticed, the professor says.
Did she confide in you about any personal problems?
I'm not exactly the warm and fuzzy type, the professor says wryly. Our communication was strictly advisor-advisee in an academic sense. The only extracurricular activities I even know she participated in are education-related. She organizes the Special Olympics here in town, and she tutors an autistic boy.
Suddenly the professor frowns.
Has anyone contacted him? He'll have a hard time coping if Jess doesn't show up for her scheduled appointment. Changes in routine are very traumatic for kids like Jacob.
Jacob? I repeat, and I open the day timer. This is the boy whose mother left a message on the answering machine at the professor's house. The boy whose name is entered into Jess's schedule on the day she disappeared. Professor? I say, you wouldn't happen to know where he lives. Jacob Hunt and his family reside in a part of Townsend that's a little more run down than the rest of it. The part you have to work harder to find behind the picture postcard town green and the stately New England antique homes. Their house is just beyond the condos that are filled with the recently separated and newly divorced, past the train tracks for an Amtrak route that's long defunct. The woman who opens the door has a blue stain on her shirt and dark hair wound into a messy knot. And the most beautiful eyes I have ever seen. They're pale, like a lioness's, nearly golden. But they also look like they've done their share of crying. And we all know that a sky with clouds in it is much more interesting than one that doesn't have any. I'd place her in her early 40s. She's holding a spoon, which is dribbling its contents onto the floor.
I don't want any, she says, starting to close the door.
I'm not selling anything, I say. You're dripping. She glances down and then sticks the spoon into her mouth. That's when I remember why I'm here. I hold up my badge. I'm Detective Rich Mattson. Are you Jacob's mother?
Oh, God, she says. I thought he'd already called you to apologize.
Apologize?
It's really not his fault, she interjects. Granted, I should have known that he was sneaking out, but with him, this hobby is almost a pathology. If there's any way I can convince you to keep this quiet, not a bribe, of course, just maybe a handshake agreement. You see, if it becomes public knowledge, then my career could really take a hit, and I'm a single mom who's barely scraping by as is.
She's babbling, and I have no idea what the hell she's talking about. Although I did hear the word single. I'm sorry, Miss Hunt.
Emma.
Emma, then. I have no idea what you're talking about. I came because your son is tutored by Jess Ogilvie?
Oh, she says, sobering. I heard about Jess on the news. Her poor parents must be frantic. Are there any leads yet?
That's why I'm here to speak to your son. Those eyes of hers darken.
You can't possibly think Jacob had anything to do with her disappearance.
No, but he was the last appointment in her date book before she disappeared. She folds her arms.
Detective Mattson, my son has Asperger's syndrome.
Okay, and I'm red-green colorblind, whatever.
It's high-functioning autism. He doesn't even know Jess is missing yet. He's had a hard time lately, and the news could be devastating to him.
I can be sensitive about the subject. She measures me for a moment with her gaze. Then, turning, she heads into the house, expecting me to follow.
Jacob,
she calls as we reach the kitchen. I stand in the entryway, waiting for a child to appear. After all, Jess Ogilvie is a teacher, and Professor Gorgona referred to a boy she worked with. Instead, a behemoth teenager who's taller than I am, and probably stronger, shuffles into the room. This is who Jess Ogilvie tutored? I stare at him for a second, trying to place the reason he looks so familiar out of context. And suddenly it comes to me. Hypothermic man. This kid identified the cause of death before the medical examiner did.
You? I say. You're Jacob Hunt?
Now his mother's rushed apologies make sense. She probably thought I'd come to slap a fine on the kid, or arrest him for interfering with a crime scene.
Jacob, she says dryly, I think you're already acquainted with Detective Mattson.
Hi, Jacob. I hold out a hand. Nice to officially meet you. He doesn't shake it. He doesn't even look me in the eye.
I saw the article in the paper,
he says, his voice flat and robotic.
It was buried in the back. If you ask me, someone dying of hypothermia is worthy of at least page 2.
He takes a step forward.
Did the full autopsy results come back? It would be interesting to know if the alcohol lowered the freezing point for the body, or if there's not a significant change.
So, Jake, I say.
Jacob. My name is Jacob, not Jake.
Right, Jacob. I was hoping to ask you a few questions.
If they're about forensics,
he says, growing animated,
then I am more than happy to help. Have you heard about the research coming out of Purdue on desorption electrospray ionization? They found that the sweat from finger pores slightly corrodes metal surfaces, anything from a bullet to a piece of a bomb. If you spray the fingerprints with positively charged water, the droplets dissolve chemicals in the fingerprints and transfer minute amounts that can be analyzed by mass spectrometer. Can you imagine how handy it would be to not only get fingerprint images, but also identify the chemicals in them? You could not only place a suspect at a crime scene, but also get proof that he handled explosives.
I look at Emma Hunt, begging for help.
Jacob, Detective Mattson needs to talk to you about something else. You want to sit down for a minute?
A minute, because it's almost 4:30.
And what, I wonder, happens at 4:30? His mother doesn't react at all to his comment. I feel a little like Alice in Wonderland, in the Disney video that Sasha likes to watch on her weekends with me. And everyone is in on the un-birthday routine but me. Last time we'd watched it, I realized that being a parent wasn't all that different. We're always bluffing, pretending we know best, when most of the time we're just praying we won't screw up too badly. Well then, I say to Jacob, I guess I'd better start.
Emma. The only reason I let Rich Mattson into my house is because I'm still not entirely sure that he doesn't want to punish Jacob for showing up at his crime scene last weekend, and I'll do whatever I have to do to make that whole nightmare go away. Jacob, I say, Detective Mattson needs to talk to you about something else. You want to sit down for a minute?
We're racing against a clock, not that Mattson would understand. A minute, because it's almost 4:30, Jacob tells me. I don't know how anyone could look at Jacob and think he'd be a viable witness. Sure, his mind is a steel trap, but half the time there's no lock to get inside it. The detective sits at the kitchen table. I turn down the flame on the stove and then join him. Jacob is struggling to look in Mattson's direction, but his eyelids keep fluttering, as if he's staring into the sun. And finally he gives up and lets his gaze slide away.
You have a friend named Jess, right?
The detective asks.
Yes. What do you and Jess do together? We practice social skills, conversations, goodbyes, things like that.
He hesitates.
She's my best friend.
This doesn't surprise me. Jacob's definition of a friend isn't legitimate. To him, a friend might be the kid whose locker is next to his in school, who therefore has an interaction at least once a day to say, "Could you move over?" A friend is someone who he's never met, but who doesn't actively taunt him in school. Jess may be paid by me to meet with Jacob, but that doesn't take away from the fact that she honestly cares about him and connects with him. The detective looks at Jacob, who of course isn't looking at him. I watch people falter over that normal courtesy of communication all the time. After a while, it feels like staring, so they look away from Jacob, mirroring his behavior. Sure enough, after a moment, Mattson stares down at the table as if there's something fascinating in the wood grain.
Right now, Jacob, Jess is missing, and it's my job to find her.
I suck in my breath. That's what you call sensitive? But Jacob doesn't seem to be surprised, which makes me wonder if he's seen the news or read about the disappearance in the papers or online.
Jess is gone,
he repeats. The detective leans forward.
Were you supposed to meet with her last Tuesday?
Yes,
Jacob says.
At 2:35.
And did you?
No.
Suddenly, Jacob's breakdown makes perfect sense. To travel to Jess's unfamiliar new residence, which already would have set off his alarm bells, and then to never have Jess show up? Well, talk about a perfect storm for an AS kid. Oh, Jacob, was that why you had a meltdown?
Meltdown?
Mattson echoes. I glance at him briefly. When Jacob's routine is disrupted, he gets very agitated. This was a double whammy, and by the time he came home, I break off, suddenly remembering something else. You walked home from Jess's place? Alone? It isn't that he wouldn't know the way. Jacob is a veritable human GPS. He can take one look at a map and have it memorized. But knowing geography and knowing how to follow directions are two very different things. Getting from point A to point B to point C inevitably trips him up.
Yes, Jacob says. It wasn't so bad.
It was nearly 8 miles, in the freezing cold. I suppose I should consider us lucky. On top of everything else, Jacob could have wound up with pneumonia.
How long did you wait for her?
Jacob looks up at the clock. He starts rubbing the tips of his fingers against his thumbs, back and forth.
I have to go now.
I notice the detective staring at Jacob as he fidgets, and I know damn well what he's thinking. I bet when you see someone who doesn't make eye contact and who can't sit still, you immediately assume guilt, I say. Me? I assume he's on the spectrum.
It's 4:30.
Jacob's voice is louder, more urgent. You can go watch Crime Busters, I tell him, and he bolts into the living room. The detective stares at me, dumbfounded.
Excuse me, I was in the middle of an interrogation.
I thought this wasn't an interrogation. A young girl's life might be at stake, and you think it's more important for your son to watch a television show? Yes, I snap. It doesn't strike you as odd that your son isn't upset by his tutor's disappearance? My son didn't even get upset when his grandfather died, I reply. It was a forensics adventure for him. His feelings about Jess going missing will be determined only by how it affects him, which is the way he measures everything. When he realizes that his Sunday session with Jess might not take place, then he'll get upset. The detective looks at me for a long moment. I think he's going to give me a lecture about obstruction of justice. But instead, he tilts his head to one side, thoughtful. That must be really hard on you. I don't remember the last time anyone has said those words to me. I wouldn't trade Jacob for the world, for his tenderness, his incredible brain, his devotion to following rules. But that doesn't mean it's been an easy ride. An ordinary mother doesn't worry about whether her son being shunned at a school concert hurts him as much as it hurts me. An ordinary mother doesn't call Green Mountain Power when the electricity goes out to say that one of the residents has a disability that requires immediate intervention. Because missing crime busters actually qualifies when it comes to Jacob. An ordinary mother doesn't lie awake at night wondering if Theo will ever accept his brother enough to watch over him when I'm gone. It's my life, I say, shrugging. Do you work outside the home? Are you interviewing me too? Just making conversation until the commercial break, he says, smiling. Ignoring him, I stand up and stir the blueberries I'm cooking down for tonight's pie filling. Your son, he took us by surprise the other night, Mattson continues. We're not used to minors crashing our crime scenes. Technically, he's not a minor, he's 18. Well, he's got more forensic scientific knowledge than guys I know who are four times his age. Tell me something I don't know. You've got pretty eyes, the detective says. Fumbling, I drop the spoon into the pot. What did you just say? You heard me, Mattson replies, and he walks into the living room to wait for the opening credits of Crime Busters to finish.
Jacob. I've never been a big fan of I Love Lucy. That said, every time I see the episode where Lucy and Ethel are working at the candy factory and get behind on the packaging, it makes me laugh. The way they stuff the candy into their mouths and inside their uniforms, well, you know it's going to end with Lucy wailing her famous wail. Having Detective Mattson ask me these questions makes me feel like Lucy at the candy factory. At first, I can keep up, especially after I realize that he is not angry at me for coming to the hypothermic man's crime scene. But then it begins to get more complicated. The questions stack up like that candy, and I'm still trying to wrap the last one when he sends the next one my way. All I want to do is take his words and stuff them somewhere where I don't have to hear them anymore. Detective Mattson is standing in front of me as soon as the first commercial airs. It's for Petipaws, a new incredible pet nail trimmer. That makes me think of the miniature poodle at the pizza place that we saw. And that makes me think of Jess. And that makes me feel like there's a bird caught inside my ribcage. What would he say if he knew that right now, in my pocket, is Jess's pink cell phone? Just a couple more questions, Jacob, he promises. I'll make sure I'm done in 90 seconds. He smiles, but it's not because he's happy. I had a biology teacher like that once. When I corrected Mr. Hubbard's mistakes in class, he smiled with the left side of his mouth. I assumed that meant he was grateful. But that weird half-smile apparently meant he was annoyed with me. even though if someone's smiling, it's supposed to signify that they're cheerful. So I got sent to the principal's office for my bad attitude when, really, it was just because the expressions on people's faces are not always reflections of how they feel inside. He glances at my notebook. What's that for? I take notes on the episodes, I tell him. I have over 100. Episodes? Notebooks. He nods. Was Mark at Jess's place when you got there? No. Now the commercial on television is for denture cream. Secretly, I am very scared of losing all my teeth. Sometimes I dream about waking up and finding them rolling around on my tongue like marbles. I close my eyes so I don't have to watch. You know Mark? We've met, the detective says. Did you and Jess ever talk about him? My eyes are still closed, so maybe that's why I see what I do. Mark, with his hands sliding up Jessica's shirt at the pizza place. His hideous orange sweatshirt. The earring in his left ear. The bruises I saw once on Jessica's side when she reached for a book on a high shelf. Two uneven purple ovals like quality stamps on a cut of beef. She told me she'd fallen off a stepladder, but she looked away when she said it. And unlike me, who looks away out of comfort, she does it in moments of discomfort. I see Mark smiling with only half his mouth, too. Now, the commercial is for Law & Order SVU, a promo, which means that the next image on the screen will be Crime Busters again. I pick up my pen and turn the page in my notebook. Did Jess and Mark fight? The detective asks again. On the TV, Rihanna is in the woods with Kurt, and they're investigating a dead dog with a human finger found undigested in its stomach. Jacob?
Hasta la vista, baby, I murmur. And I make up my mind that, no matter what this detective says to me, I'm not speaking again until my show is over.
Theo. So I'm headed downstairs to get something to eat, when I hear a voice in the kitchen I don't recognize. This is pretty extraordinary. I'm not the only one who doesn't have friends as a result of Jacob's Asperger's. I can probably count on one hand the number of people my mother has ever trusted enough to invite over. The fact that the voice is male is even more bizarre. And then I hear my mom refer to him as Detective Mattson. Holy crap. I run back upstairs and lock myself in my room. He's here because of Jess Ogilvy, and I'm officially freaked out. And for the record, still hungry. Here's what I know for sure. Jess was alive and well at about 1 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday. I know this because I saw her. All of her. Her tits, let me just say, rank right up there as masterworks of art. I'd say we were equally surprised when she reached for her towel, wiped her eyes, and looked in the mirror. She certainly didn't expect to find some random guy in her house watching her naked. And I sure as hell didn't expect the object of my momentary lust to be my brother's tutor. Hey, she yelled. And in one smooth move, she grabbed the towel and wrapped it around herself. Me, meanwhile, I was totally paralyzed. I stood there like an idiot until I realized she was pissed and she was coming after me. The only reason I got away is that the floor of the bathroom was wet. When she stumbled, I flew out of the master bedroom where I'd been standing, down the stairs. In my hurry, I crashed into some of the furniture and knocked a whole mess of papers off the kitchen counter. But I didn't care. All I wanted to do was get the hell out of that house and join a monastery, or hop on a plane to Micronesia, anything that would put me far away by the time Jess Ogilvy asked my brother and my mom whether they were aware that Theo Hunt was a peeping Tom, a total perv. But sometime between now and then, Jess Ogilvy got dressed, left her house, and vanished. Is she wandering around with amnesia? Or hiding out and plotting some kind of revenge scheme against me? I don't know. I can't tell the cops, though, without incriminating myself. It's just past 5:30 when I get the nerve to leave my bedroom. I can smell blueberry pie cooking. The only good thing about Blue Food Fridays, if you ask me. And no, it will be ready at 6. Like everything else, we eat on a schedule to keep Jacob calm. The door to his room is open, and he's standing on his desk chair, slipping one of his Crime Busters journals back into its predetermined spot on a shelf. "Hey," I say to him. He doesn't answer. Instead, he sits down on the bed with his back to the wall and picks up a book on his nightstand. "I saw the cops were here." "Cop," Jacob murmurs. Singular. "What did he want to talk to you about?" "Jess." "What did you tell him?" Jacob draws his knees up to his chest. "If you build it, he will come." My brother may not communicate the way the rest of us do, but after all this time, I've learned to read him loud and clear. When he doesn't feel like talking, he hides behind someone else's words. I sit beside him, just staring at the wall while he reads. I want to tell him that I saw Jess alive on Tuesday. I want to ask him if he did as well, and if that's part of the reason he doesn't want to talk to the police either. I wonder if he's got something to hide, too. For the first time in my life, Jacob and I just might have something in common.
Emma. It all starts with a mouse. After our weekly Saturday shopping excursion, thank goodness the free sample lady had been replaced temporarily by a sullen teenager handing out vegetarian cocktail wieners at the door of the grocery store, I leave Jacob sitting at the kitchen table with the remainders of his lunch while I do a cursory cleaning of his room. He forgets to bring glasses and bowls of cereal downstairs to the kitchen, and if I don't play middleman, we wind up with thriving colonies of mold that have bonded to my dishes like concrete. I pick up a bevy of mugs from his desk and spot the tiny face of a field mouse struggling to survive this winter by taking up residence behind Jacob's computer. I'm embarrassed to admit I have a very typical female reaction and go completely ballistic. Unfortunately, I'm holding a half-full glass of chocolate soy milk at the time, and most of it spills over Jacob's comforter. Well, it has to be washed. Although it's the weekend, and that's problematic. Jacob doesn't like seeing his bed stripped. It has to be made at all times unless he happens to be in it. Usually I wash his sheets while he's at school. Sighing, I pull fresh sheets out of the linen closet and tug the winter comforter off his bed. He can make do for a night with his summertime quilt, an old postage stamp design in all the rainbow colors, Roy G. Biv, in correct order, which my mother sewed for him before she died. The summer quilt is kept in a black trash bag on the upper shelf of his closet. I pull it down and shake out the blanket inside. A backpack rolled into its center tumbles to the floor. It's clearly not one that belongs to the boys. Flesh-colored with red and black stripes, it seems to be trying to be a Burberry knockoff, but the stripes are too wide and the colors too bright. There's still a Marshall's tag on the strap, with the price ripped off. Inside is a toothbrush, a satin blouse, a pair of shorts, and a yellow t-shirt. The blouse and shorts are both plus size. The t-shirt is much smaller and says Special Olympics on the front and staff on the back. At the very bottom of the backpack is a note card, still inside its torn envelope. There's a picture of a snowy landscape, and the inside reads, in spidery handwriting, "Merry Christmas, Jess. Love, Aunt Ruth." "My God," I murmur. "What did you do?" I close my eyes for a moment, and then I bellow Jacob's name. He comes running into his room, stopping abruptly when he sees me holding the backpack in my arms. "Oh," he says. He sounds as if I've caught him in a white lie. "Jacob, did you wash your hands before dinner?" "Yes, Mom." "Then how come the bar of soap's still dry?" "Oh." But this isn't a white lie. This is a girl who's missing, a girl who could be dead by now, a girl whose backpack and clothes my son inexplicably has. Jacob starts to flee downstairs, but I grab his arm to stop him. "Where did this come from?"
"A box at Jess's place,"
he grinds out, shutting his eyes tight until I let go. "Tell me why you have this, because a lot of people are searching for Jess, and this does not look good." His hand starts twitching at his side.
"I told you I went to her house Tuesday like I was supposed to and things weren't right."
"What do you mean?"
"There were stools knocked over in the kitchen and papers all over the floor, and all the CDs were thrown on the carpet. It wasn't right. It wasn't right."
"Jacob," I say, "focus. How did you get this backpack? Does Jess know you have it?" There are tears in his eyes.
"No, she was already gone."
He starts to walk in a small circle, his hand still flapping.
"I went in, and the mess, and I was scared. I didn't know what happened. I called out her name and she wouldn't answer, and I saw the backpack and the other things and I took them."
His voice is a roller coaster reeling off track.
"Houston, we have a problem."
"It's okay," I say, wrapping my arms around him and holding him with the deepest pressure, the way a potter would center the clay on her wheel. But it isn't okay. It won't be. Until Jacob gives Detective Mattson this new information.
Rich. I am not in a good mood. It's Saturday, and although I'm supposed to have Sasha for the weekend, I had to cancel as soon as it became apparent that we had an ongoing investigation that demanded my full resources. Basically, I'm going to eat, sleep, and breathe Jess Ogilvy until I find her, dead or alive. Not that that seemed to sway my ex, who made sure to give me a 15-minute tongue-lashing about parental responsibility, and how on earth was she supposed to carry on with her life when my emergencies kept interrupting. It wasn't worth pointing out that this was not my emergency, technically, or that the disappearance of a young woman might take precedence over rescheduling a date night with her new spouse, Mr. Coffee. I tell myself that missing one weekend with Sasha is worth it, if I can make sure that Claude Ogilvy gets to have another weekend with his daughter. En route to Jess's home, where a team of CSIs is entrenched, I get a call from the local FBI field agent, who has been trying to ping the girl's cell phone. "You're not getting a signal?" I repeat. "So what does that mean?" "Several things," the agent explains. "The GPS locator only works when the phone's active, so it could be at the bottom of a lake right now. Or she could be alive and well and just have run out of juice." "Well, how am I supposed to know which of those it is?" "Guess once you find a body, it'll be pretty clear," he says. And then I drive through one of Vermont's notorious dead zones, and the call is dropped. When the phone rings again, I'm still cursing out the FBI, which is good for one thing and one thing only, screwing up a perfectly sound local investigation. So you can imagine how surprised I am to hear Emma Hunt on the end of the line. I had left her my card yesterday, just in case.
"I was hoping you might be able to come back to my house," she says. "Jacob has something he needs to tell you."
I have a team of investigators waiting for me on site. I have a surly boyfriend who might be a murderer, and a state senator breathing down my boss's neck, demanding my job if I don't find his missing kid. But I put on my flashing blues and do an illegal U-turn. "Give me 10 minutes," I tell her. I'm in a slightly better mood now. I have, fortunately, 3 whole hours before Crime Busters airs. We are sitting in the living room, Emma and Jacob on one couch, me on a side chair.
"Tell the detective everything you told me, Jacob," Emma says.
His eyes roll upward, as if he's reading something printed on the ceiling.
"I went to her house that day like I was supposed to. Things weren't right. There were stools knocked over in the kitchen, and papers all over the floor, and all the CDs were thrown on the carpet. It wasn't right. It wasn't right."
His voice seems almost computerized. It's that mechanical.
"She was already gone. I went in, and the mess, and I was scared. I didn't know what happened. I called out her name, and she wouldn't answer, and I saw the backpack and the other things, and I took them. Houston, we have a problem."
He nods, satisfied.
"That's it."
"Why did you lie to me about going to Jess's?" I ask.
"I didn't lie," he says. "I told you I didn't have my session with her."
"You didn't tell me about the backpack either," I point out. "It sits between us on a coffee table." Jacob nods.
"You didn't ask."
"Wise ass," I think, just as Emma jumps in.
"A kid with Asperger's, like Jacob, is going to be painfully literal," she says.
"So if I question him directly, he'll answer directly?"
"He," Jacob interjects testily, "is sitting within earshot."
That makes me grin. "Sorry," I say, addressing him. "How did you get into Jess's house?"
"She used to leave her dorm room open for me, and when I got to her house, that door was left open too. So I went in to wait."
"What did you see when you went inside?"
"The kitchen was a mess. Stools were knocked over and the mail was all over the floor."
"How about Jess? Was she there?"
"No. I called her name and she didn't answer."
"What did you do?" He shrugs.
"I cleaned up."
I sink back into the cushions of the chair. "You cleaned up?"
"Yes, that's correct."
My mind is racing through all the tampered evidence sacrificed to Jacob Hunt's obsessive-compulsive tendencies. "You know all about preserving evidence at crime scenes," I say. "What on earth would make you destroy it?" Just like that, Emma bristles.
"My sons, doing you a favor by speaking with you, detective. We didn't have to call and give you this information."
I tamp down my frustration. "So you cleaned up the mess you saw downstairs?"
"Right," Jacob says. "I picked up the stools, and I set the mail back onto the kitchen counter. And I put all the CDs that had been knocked over in alphabetical order."
"Alphabetical order?" I repeat, remembering Mark McGuire's call and my theory about an anal-retentive kidnapper. "You're kidding me."
"That's what his room's like," Emma says. "Jacob's a big fan of everything being in its right place. For him, it's the spatial equivalent of knowing what's coming next."
"So when did you take the backpack?"
"After I cleaned up."
"The backpack still has its tags on, just like McGuire said. Would you mind if I hang on to it for the case?" Suddenly, Jacob lights up.
"You have to take it. You're going to need to run DNA tests on the straps, and you can do an AP on the underwear inside. It might be worth spraying the whole thing with luminol, to be honest, and you can probably get prints off the card inside with ninhydrin, but you'll want to compare them against my mother's, since she handled the card when she first found the backpack. Which reminds me, you can look through it now if you want. I have latex gloves upstairs in my room. You don't have a latex allergy, do you?"
He is halfway out of the room when he turns back.
"We have a grocery bag somewhere, don't we? That way Detective Madsen can carry this back to the lab."
He runs upstairs and I turn to Emma. "Is he always like that?"
and then some. She looks up at me. Is anything Jacob said helpful?
It's all food for thought, I say.
Everything changes if there are signs of a struggle, she points out.
I raise a brow. You're a closet CSI too?
No, in spite of Jacob's best efforts to teach me.
She glances out the window for a moment.
I've been thinking about Jess's mother, she says. The last time she talked to her daughter, was it about stupid things, you know? Did they have a fight about how she never called or how she had forgotten to send a thank you card to her aunt?
She faces me.
I used to say I love you every time I tucked my boys in at night, but now they go to bed after I do.
My dad used to say that living with regrets was like driving a car that only moved in reverse. I smile faintly. He had a stroke a few years ago. Before that, I used to screen his calls because I didn't have time to talk about whether the Sox would make it into the playoffs. But afterward, I started to call him. Every time, I'd finish by saying I loved him. We both knew why, and it didn't sit right after all the time I hadn't said it. It was like trying to bail out an ocean of water with a teaspoon. He died 8 months ago.
I'm sorry.
I laugh tightly. And I don't know why the hell I'm telling you this. At that moment, Jacob reappears, clutching a pair of latex gloves. I snap them on and carefully lift the backpack just as my cell rings. Matson, I say. It's one of the lieutenants in the department, asking how much longer I'm going to be. I have to run. I lift the grocery bag into my arms. Jacob ducks his head.
I'd be interested in hearing the test results, naturally.
Naturally, I reply, although I have no intent of sharing them. So, what's on Crime Busters today?
Episode 67, the one where a mutilated woman is found in a shopping cart outside a box store.
I remember that one. Keep an eye on
the store manager, Jacob finishes. I've seen it already, too.
He walks me to the door, his mother trailing behind. Thanks, Jacob. And Emma? I wait until she glances up. Say it when you wake them up in the morning instead. When I reach Jess Ogilvie's place, the two CSIs who have been processing the house are standing outside in the freezing cold, staring at a cut window screen. No prints? I say, my breath fogging in the cold. But I already know the answer. So would Jacob, for that matter. The chances of prints being preserved in temperatures as low as these are pretty slim.
No, the first investigator says. Marcy's a bombshell with a knockout figure, a 155 IQ,
and a girlfriend who could probably knock my teeth out.
But we did find the window jimmy to break the lock, too, and a screwdriver in the bushes.
Nice. So the question is, was this a B&D gone bad, or was the screen cut to make us think that? Basil, the second investigator, shakes his head. Nothing inside screams breaking and entering. Yeah, well, that's not necessarily true. I just interviewed a witness who says otherwise and who, cleaned up. Marcy looks at Basil.
So he's a suspect, not a witness?
No, he's an autistic kid. Long story. I look at the edge of the screen. What kind of knife was used?
Probably one from the kitchen. We got a bunch to take back to the lab to see if any of them have traces of metal on the blade.
You get any prints inside?
Yeah, in the bathroom and off the computer, plus a few partials around the kitchen.
But in this case, Mark McGuire's prints won't raise a red flag. He's admitted to living here part-time with Jess. We also got a partial boot print, Basil says. The silver lining to it being crap weather for prints on the sill is that it's perfect for footwear impressions. Underneath the overhang of the gutter, I can see the red splotch of spray wax he's used to make a cast. He's lucky to have found a protected ledge. There's been a dusting of fresh snow since Tuesday. It's the heel, and there's a star in the center, surrounded by what looks like the spokes of a compass. Once Basil photographs it, we can enter it into a database to see what kind of boot it is. The sound of a car driving down the street is punctuated by the slam of a door. Then footsteps approach, crunching on the snow. If that's the press, I say to Marcy, shoot first. But it's not the press. It's Mark McGuire, looking like he hasn't slept since I last saw him. It's about fucking time you got around to looking for my girlfriend, he shouts. And even from a few feet away, the fumes of alcohol on his breath reach me. Mr. McGuire, I say, moving slowly toward him. You happen to know if this screen's always been cut? I watch him carefully to see his reaction. But the truth is, I can amass all the evidence I want against Mark McGuire, and I still have nothing to arrest him for unless a body is recovered. He squints at the window, but the sun is in his eyes, as well as the brilliant reflection of snow on the ground. As he moves a little closer, Basil steps behind him and shoots a jet of spray wax on the boot print he left behind. Even from this far away, I can make out the star and the spokes of a compass. Mr. McGuire, I say, we're going to have to take your boots.
Jacob. The first time I saw a dead person was at my grandfather's funeral. It was after the service, when the minister had read aloud from the Bible, even though my grandfather did not routinely go to church or consider himself religious. Strangers got up and talked about my grandfather, calling him Joseph and telling stories about parts of his life that were news to me. His service during the Korean War, his childhood on the Lower East Side, his courtship of my grandmother at a high school carnival kissing booth. All of their words landed on me like hornets, and I couldn't make them go away until I could see the grandfather I knew and remembered, instead of this imposter they were all discussing. My mother was not crying so much as dissolving. That is the one way I can describe the fact that tears had become so normal for her, it looked strange to see her face smooth and dry. It should be noted that I do not always understand body language. That's quite normal for someone with Asperger's. It's pointless to expect me to look at someone and know how she is feeling simply because her smile is too tight and she is hunched over and hugging her arms to herself, just as it would be pointless to expect a deaf person to hear a voice. Which means that when I asked to have my grandfather's coffin opened, I shouldn't be blamed for not realizing it would upset my mother even more. I just wanted to see if the body inside was still my grandfather, or maybe the man all those speakers had known, or something entirely different. I'm skeptical about lights and tunnels and afterlives, and this seemed the most logical way to test my theories. Here is what I learned. Dead isn't angels or ghosts. It's a physical state of breakdown, a change in all those carbon atoms that create the temporary house of a body so that they can return to their most elemental stage. I don't really see why that freaks people out, since it's the most natural cycle in the world. The body in the coffin still looked like my grandfather. When I touched his cheek, though, with its cross-hatched wrinkles, the skin no longer felt like human skin. It was cold and slightly firm, like pudding that's been left too long in the refrigerator and has developed a virtual hide as a surface crust. I may not understand emotion, but I can feel guilt about not understanding it. So when I finally cornered my mother, hours after she ran sobbing from the sight of me poking the thing that used to be my grandfather's cheek, I tried to explain why she shouldn't be crying. He's not Grandpa, I told her. I checked. Remarkably, this did not make her feel better at all. That doesn't mean I miss him any less, my mother said. Pure logic suggests that if the entity in the coffin is not fundamentally the person you used to know, you cannot miss him, Because that's not a loss, that's a change. My mother had shaken her head. Here's what I miss, Jacob. I miss the fact that I won't get to ever hear his voice again, and that I can't talk to him anymore. This wasn't really true. We had Grandpa's voice immortalized on old family videos that I sometimes liked to watch when I couldn't sleep at night. And it wasn't that she couldn't talk to him that was hard for her to accept. It was that he could no longer talk back. My mother had sighed. You'll get it one day, I hope. I would like to be able to tell her that yes, now I get it. When someone dies, it feels like the hole in your gum when a tooth falls out. You can chew, you can eat, you have plenty of other teeth, but your tongue keeps going back to that empty place where all the nerves are still a little raw. I'm headed to my meeting with Jess. I'm late. It's 3 a.m., which is really Monday, not Sunday. But there's no other time for me to go, with my mother watching over me. And although she will probably argue that I broke a house rule, technically I didn't. This isn't sneaking out to a crime scene. The crime scene is 300 yards away from where I'm headed. My backpack is full of necessities. My bike whispers on the pavement as I pedal fast. It's easier not being on foot this time, not having to support more than my own weight. Directly behind the yard of the house into which Jess had moved is a small, scraggly forest. And directly behind that is Route 115. It runs across a bridge over the culvert that siphons the runoff from the woods in the spring, when the water level is high. I noticed it last Tuesday when I took the bus from school to Jess's new residence. My mind is full of maps, from social flowcharts, person is frowning, leads to person keeps trying to interrupt, leads to person takes step backward, equals, person wants to leave this conversation, desperately. To grids of relativity, like an interpersonal version of Google Earth. Kid says to me, "You play baseball? What position? Left out?" and gets a big laugh from the rest of the class. Kid is one person out of 6.92 billion humans on this planet. This planet is only 1/8 of the solar system, whose sun is one of 2 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Put that way, the comment loses its importance. But my mind also functions geographically and topographically, so that at any given moment I can locate myself. This shower stall is on the upper level of the house at 132 Bird's Eye Lane, Townsend, Vermont, United States, North America, Western Hemisphere, planet Earth. So by the time I got to Jess's new house last Tuesday, I completely understood where it lay in relation to everywhere else I'd ever been. Jess is just where I left her 5 days ago, propped against the damp stone wall. I lean my bike against the far end of the culvert and squat down, shining a flashlight into her face. Jess is dead. When I touch her cheek with the backs of my knuckles, it feels like marble. That reminds me, and so I open up my backpack and pull out the blanket. It's a silly thing, I know, but so is leaving flowers on a grave, and this seems to make more sense. I tuck it around Jess's shoulders and make sure it covers her feet. Then I sit down beside her. I put on a pair of latex gloves and I hold Jess's hand for a moment before taking out my notebook. In it, I begin to write down the physical evidence. The bruises underneath her eyes, the missing tooth, the contusions on her upper arms, which are, of course, covered up by her sweatshirt right now. The leathery yellow scrapes on her lower back, which are also covered by that sweatshirt. To be honest, I'm a little disappointed. I would have expected the police to be able to read the clues I left behind. But they haven't found Jess, and so I have to take the next step. Her phone is still in my pocket. I have carried it everywhere with me, although I've only turned it on 5 times. Detective Mattson would have subpoenaed Jess's cell phone records by now. They'll see the instances when I called her residence to listen to her voice on the answering machine. but they will assume it was Jess herself who made the call. He's probably tried to locate her by GPS, too, which nearly all phones have now, and which can be accessed by the FBI using a computer program that will pinpoint an active phone within a range of a few feet. This was first piloted in emergency response programs, namely the 911 call. As soon as dispatch picks up on the other end, they begin to track, just in case an officer or an ambulance has to be sent out. I decide to make it easy for them. I sit down next to Jess again, so that our shoulders are touching. "You are the best friend I ever had," I tell her. "I wish this had never happened." Jess, of course, does not respond. I cannot say whether she has ceased to be, or if this is just her body, and the thing that makes Jess Jess has gone somewhere else. It makes me think of my meltdown, of the room with no windows, no doors, the country where nobody speaks to each other, the piano with only black keys. Maybe this is why funeral dirges are always in a minor key. Being on the other side of dead isn't that different from having Asperger's. It would be incredible to stay and watch. There is nothing I would like more than to see the police swarm in to rescue Jess. But that would be too risky, and so I know I'll just get on my bike and be safe and sound in my bed before the sun or my mother rises for the day. First, though, I power up her pink Motorola. It feels like I should recite something, a tribute or a prayer. "ET phone home," I finally say, and then I press 911 and place the little receiver on the stone beside her. Through the speakers, I can hear the voice of the dispatcher. "What is your emergency?" she says. "Hello? Is anybody there?" I am halfway through the woods when I see the flashing lights in the distance on Route 115, and I smile to myself the whole rest of the way home. Case 4. Something's Fishy. Something Stella Nickel loved, tropical fish. She dreamed of opening her own store. Something Stella Nickel did not love, her husband, whom she poisoned in 1986 with Excedrin capsules she'd laced with cyanide in order to collect on his life insurance policies. She first attempted to poison Bruce Nickel with hemlock and foxglove, but neither worked on him. So instead, she contaminated Excedrin capsules. In order to cover her tracks, she also placed several packages of poisoned Excedrin in three different stores, leading to the death of Sue Snow, who had the bad luck to have been shopping at one of them. The drug manufacturers released the batch numbers of the pills to warn consumers, which was when Stella Nickel came forward and told authorities she had two bottles of contaminated pills that had been purchased from two different stores. This seemed unlikely, since out of thousands of bottles that had been checked in that region, only 5 were found to have tainted capsules. What were the odds of Stella having 2 of those? While examining the Excedrin capsules, the FBI lab found an essential clue. Green crystals were mixed in with the cyanide. These turned out to be algae destroyer, a product used in fish tanks. Stella Nickel had an aquarium and had bought algae destroyer at a local fish store. According to the police, Stella had crushed some algae tablets for her beloved fish in a bowl and then, later, used the same bowl to mix the cyanide. Stella's estranged daughter subsequently went to the police and testified that her mother had planned to kill Bruce Nickel for years. Talk about the mother of all headaches.
Chapter 4. Rich. Sometimes I'm just too damn late. Last year, the day after Christmas, a 13-year-old girl named Gracie Cheever never came downstairs. She was found hanging from a closet rack. When I arrived with the CSIs who were photographing the scene, the first thing I noticed was what a mess Gracie's room was. Cereal bowls stacked high, and papers and dirty laundry thrown on the floor. No one ever asked this kid to clean up. I looked through her journals and learned that Gracie was a cutter. Gracie hated her life and herself. Gracie hated her face and thought she was fat, and wrote down every morsel she ate and every time she cheated on her diet. And then on one page, "I miss my mom." I asked one of the patrol officers if the mother was dead, and he shook his head. "She's in the kitchen," he said. Gracie was the older child of two. She had a younger sister with Down syndrome, and boy, did her mom live for that kid. She homeschooled her. She did the girl's physical therapy on mats in the family room, and while her mother was busy being a saint, Gracie's dad was molesting her. I took Gracie's journal back to the station, and I Xeroxed it twice. It was covered with blood, because while she was writing, she was cutting herself. One copy I gave to the medical examiner. The second I brought to the chief. "Someone in this family needs to know what was going on," I told him. After Gracie was buried, I called her mother and asked to meet with her. We sat down in the living room in front of a blazing fire. At that appointment, I gave her a copy of the journal and told her I'd marked the pages that she really needed to read. She stared at me with glassy eyes and told me the family was starting fresh. She thanked me, and then, while I was watching, she threw the journal into the flames.